Welcome to the Faith Element Podcast for the November 8, 2020 session, focusing on Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. Ready or not? I'm David Cassidy.
I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Crystal Shepherd.
And I'm David Adams.
I'm curious, how do you respond when you are startled?
I cuss. I mean, most of the time, that's what's going to happen. And my kids really love to startle me. They live for sneaking up behind me. But that's typically the first reaction.
Do you mind being startled? After the initial shock?
No. It's fine. I startle very easily, too. Very easily. And so they don't have to work hard at it. You just learn, when you're somebody who startles easily, you just get used to it because it's just going to happen.
It's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get mad. I don't like to be startled, but in our house, the kids, like my husband and the kids will all try to startle each other. And I know to expect it in my house. So like I stay as cool as a cucumber. Like I don't react. And they're like, how? And I'm like, because I knew you were going to be around the corner. You do it every time I come in the house.
Every time. Yeah.
Oh, we should startle David.
Does he startle?
I don't startle by much anything.
Really. I bet you don't.
I'm startled by everything. And when it happens, it sounds like I'm playing golf again. Use those golf terms and I'm not allowed to use at my house. I've got some former interns and students who tell you that they're afraid to be near me for God might strike me down. You don't want to be close when that happened.
Mm. So you string some words together, it sounds like.
Oh, long ones. Yeah, fluently, yeah, because it's my best chance.
I love it. Usually I just have a quick burst, like a single syllable of something.
Well, it's like Star Trek where they say that perhaps it's time to use a colorful metaphor.
Yes.
So do your cats startle you, David?
Nope.
No, the cats don't.
Only if I step in something that you should have done.
Okay.
Oh, that's a different kind of startle.
And then the term's appropriate because descriptive of what's happened. I could just put a comma in there and they just assume I was talking about it.
Oh, gosh. Well, I do not like to be startled. I respond poorly and typically in an exaggerated fashion. And part of it's because I am very, how do I say, I easily get in my own little world. And so even if I'm brushing my teeth or if I'm folding clothes or whatever I'm doing, my mind is off somewhere. And so I'm incredibly easy to catch off guard. And of course, when the kids were home, they would, especially my son, would take advantage of that ruthlessly. But now Regina, she doesn't try to startle me, but she is so stealthy. I mean, she makes no sound when she moves. So she can just appear in the room suddenly. And I'm like, holy cow. And I'm climbing the walls and hanging off of things. And she's just rolling her eyes.
Is it bad?
I would love to see your exaggerated reaction because you don't respond strongly to much of anything.
Yeah, I want to startle you now. Like that. I feel like a bad person.
we'll
have to work
that out.
Regina startling him while he's on Zoom with us.
Yes.
So we can see.
She would love that. Oh, gosh. Well, hopefully we won't be startled anytime during this podcast.
Right.
Otherwise, I'll have some editing to do, apparently.
Yes, it would require some strong editing.
So we have a passage here that might, I don't know, might involve being startled or being ready to be startled. I don't know. So, David, would you help get us started with this one today?
Sure, but now I'm feeling a little startled. So you have to go with me. If I do something wrong here, just go with it, everybody. You know,
okay. We'll try to be calm.
Now, the great Curtis Mayfield once sang a song that he's known for. So I'll try that just to startle everybody. It's like, people get ready. There's a train. It's coming. You don't need no baggage. Just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the diesels humming. You don't need no ticket. No, just thank the Lord. No one was holding up lighters or anything during the course of this singing. But Of course, he is not the only one who wrote music about getting ready. In fact, I think we might say that this is one of the most popular themes in spiritual music. There was once a time when I used to sing a lot of gospel songs, both individually and part of a choir, and many times I've been asked to sing on a hill far away. Anyhow, it seemed like we were all led to sing a song about preparing for the Lord's arrival every year. I really don't remember all those songs, but the overall impression was that we were supposed to be good little white Christian boys and girls and do good things so we wouldn't have to suffer like all those other people who God doesn't like. At the end of the day, I find myself a lot more moved by Curtis, or maybe by Pacific Gas and Electric's classic song, Are You Ready? You know the one. It says, are you ready to sit by his throne? Are you ready not to be alone? Someone's coming to take you home, and if you're ready, they'll carry you home. It's a great song. I won't even try to sing that one. And I can't get the worship team from my church to try that one yet either. But I'm not giving up hope. Really, though, when we look at the story Jesus tells in Matthew 25, 1 through 13, I'm just about as dissatisfied with those traditional interpretations as I am with that other music that I try to forget. We have spent years talking about getting ready and being wise by storing up some sort of karmic points, by behaving well. But I'm not totally convinced this is the only way to interpret the story. Like most of Jesus' stories, there are a lot of messages woven into this one. For instance, who among us has never been to a wedding? You know, weddings are by their very nature unpredictable. Every time I perform one, I've advised the bride and the groom that something weird was going to happen, and that they should not get nervous when it does, don't be startled, but acknowledge that that thing that happened is a moment that they can remember forever from their special day. I've had trains and motorcycles interrupt services. I've had children wander down the aisle at inopportune times. I've seen adventures with wedding candles and rice paper, sometimes simultaneously. I've seen people forget their lines. I've seen crazy wind storms come up and blow everything, including my notes, around. I've even seen the bridesmaid have to shovel snow so they can pull the car up to the front door. Weddings are just like that. On the other hand, I don't remember seeing anybody drag along a second suit of clothes in case they spill something, or carrying emergency supplies or rations in case the wedding doesn't go as planned. Who does that? Yet, here we have a story about people who are thought wise for doing that very thing, while others are thought foolish for not doing so. Yes, there's a wisdom in being prepared. And maybe the so-called wise bridesmaids got word that there was some sort of delay, so they responded to it by bringing in some extra oil. We aren't told that part of the story. I can think of all sorts of scenarios where things could have gone sideways at a wedding. But I can think of a very few where it ends up like this. These days, if someone honors you by asking you to be a bridesmaid, you have to think that they are going to be okay if you don't do the whole lamp thing perfectly. Now, the way I interpret this story is that it is a reminder that God's reign is something you can't plan for. No amount of extra oil or perfect behavior can get you ready for it. It is inevitable, and this time there's no Iron Man to snap his fingers. It's just going to happen. When my daughter was a child, we took a trip to Hilton Head. On the last evening of the trip, we got everything packed and prepared, and everyone was told that we're going to get up shortly before sunrise that last morning and head to the beach so we could see the sun rise over the Atlantic Ocean. Afterwards, we'd come back and drive away. Morning came, and everyone got dressed to walk down to the beach. But Rebecca could not rouse herself quickly enough to be ready. Everyone but me took off to the beach so they could be there when the sun rose, and I had to urge and hustle her along. We were a few seconds late, but all the way there, I remember trying to explain to her that the other people weren't upset with her and trying to leave her behind. Instead, they were aware that the sun was going to rise whether they were there or not, and that they needed to be there. You can't tell it to wait up. It's the sun. It's going to rise when it rises. And this is the same message that these days of pandemic has taught us. It's a virus. It doesn't care about our need for freedom. It doesn't care how isolated we feel. It doesn't care about our relationships. It doesn't care what we believe about the virus itself. It just is. The whole key to living in such a time is for us to do our best and respond in the best ways possible to the inexorable danger presented by it. Until we work out some way to eradicate it, it is an unstoppable, inexorable force. In Jesus' story, God's reign is similarly unstoppable, although not, hopefully, as universally horrifying. In this case, half the bridesmaids were unable to adapt to the changing conditions, and they ultimately have failed in their attempt to cope with them. We can talk all we want about the bridal party's preparations or behavior, but the fact remains that something unanticipated happened, and they were called upon to cope with it. The wedding went on with only half a bridal party, which is a failure on the part of the entire bridal party. Heaven's reign might be like that. It's already here if we can only see it, and the various parties to its activities are already formed. We have no idea when God is going to make a move, nor what that move might be, but we are called upon to be ready to react to it when it happens. Unlike the so-called wise bridesmaids, if we are truly preparing for such a thing, we might also want to take a little time to prepare to help those who might not be ready. Yes, being prepared, as well as we can be, is important. But the most important preparation we can make is to develop our reflexes to be able to appropriately respond to this unpredictable but inevitable reality. And again, I am not saying we should not prepare for the future, nor that there is virtue in doing our best while we wait. On the other hand, I am asking, why are we waiting? And why might we be withholding something for others while we wait? Heaven is here with us, right now, and will become more fully realized over time. God is working among us, right now, even though we aren't likely to see what God is up to in our lifetimes. Let's get ready. Yes, but more than that, let's react to the here and now and be ready to move with God at all times rather than save up for a future that we just can't know. And that's a little introduction for today.
David, thank you for that intro. I was really glad to see that you helped us to focus on the here and now as opposed to a distant distant not only in time, but in place, sense that we often interpret this passage with, right? That being prepared is about preparing your soul for salvation, for the future, for eternity, and that interpretation really leaves a lot on the table. And I think you've reminded us that God's work is not delayed. God is at work right now. And even though, yes, there's an inevitability to God's work. That work is unfolding all around us every day, every moment, if we choose to see it and if we choose to participate in it. To me, that makes it an even more interesting passage when we think about, you know, what does it mean to be ready for whatever life throws at us? And in 2020, that's kind of fun to think about.
Life has thrown a lot at us. And one of the things I'm thinking, and I know I was roundabout in saying it, but you get this impression and you look at this, you think about the church as it is, and for a long time, there are some of our fellow Christians who have this attitude of, I'm doing what God has told me to do. I've got mine. I'm storing up for myself. Yes. So I don't have to care about the larger community. You know, so Jesus comes and, oh, okay, I'm going to send those other 10 out to get something, but I got mine. I don't have to share anything because I was smart and did what I was supposed to do. And if you weren't with me, then you're just out of luck.
And it's that individualistic lens that we often bring to things, which you're describing here. And I think you're right. It distorts our understanding. Mm-hmm. You're saying there is a responsibility beyond ourselves.
I mean, what would the bride have done had the ones who brought extra oil shared what they had and only got halfway through the service before the oil gave out? Would they throw them out, all of them? And you know, what kind of kingdom do we have? What kind of heaven do we have if we're willing to exclude people because they just didn't quite do it perfectly once they got there? Mm-hmm. You know, so there should be incentive not to cast them out, but to share what you have. You know, so I tend to resist stories that tell me that people are going to be excluded. I can also add that since we're using music, the song I didn't use, but I kept thinking about it, was one that Audio Adrenaline did just about 15, 20 years ago, He Moves, You Move. Because it talks about this kind of thing, being ready to react when God does something.
Mm.
Not saving up for the future, but your reaction matters. How you react? Mm. Are you ready to make the move when it occurs? What kind of moving do you do? Where I'm disappointed with this story is I just don't like the moves that people made once they realized what had gone on.
David, I'm very much like you in that I resist stories that exclude people too. That's certainly, and so I really do like the way that you've kind of approached this text, and is kind of some of the new ways that you have for us looking at it. It's a challenging text to deal with. I mean, everything that I read on it as I was preparing for it, everybody began by, this is a hard text, like every single person. and I mean, and that's the gift of the parables, right? Because they can be interpreted in so many different ways. And I often say that's the gift of scripture, because we can read the same passage and learn lots of different things from it. So I'm curious, one thing that I took from this, and I want to see how it fits in with what you're talking about, or if it fits in with what you're talking about. This idea that, so if we kind of take this out and look at this as not necessarily a one-to-one, symbol-to-symbol, like this person means this and this action means that, but more that like the story as a whole is an allegory for understanding Kingdom of God kind of conversations and the reign of the Messiah. There does seem to me to be a sense that if we think about these bridesmaids as the ones who are called wise are prepared in a way that they can respond to the bridegroom when the bridegroom comes, and that the other bridesmaids were not able to respond or felt like they had to do something else in order to be able to go to the wedding. Is there something that we can glean from that about the ways that we behave when we are waiting, as that is something that we talk about? Is there a way to make ourselves open to being ready to hear from God, kind of no matter where we find ourselves?
I tend to think so. I mean, just from what you're describing, if you're looking at the story at a high up level, you know, a mm-hmm. really high up in the sky and looking down at this entirety of the story. And I think I put this in my comments where the entire wedding party failed because half of them weren't able to do what they're supposed to do. And there's a sense though, if you read this, I don't want to put wise in quotes all the time, you know, because there can be this sense that sometimes people think, well, I've done everything I need to do. I'm good. Just pull the ladder up. I don't care about the rest of them. I got mine, you know, I'm ready. But how do we really know that? Because we don't know when, you know, the reign of heaven breaks in upon us in some way. We can't know that.
No, yeah, you're right.
You know, so something about being ready doesn't mean I got this stuff tucked in my pocket and I'm good to go. It should mean I'm ready to make sure that we can all get on the bus when it pulls up to the stop.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And if you think about it, I mean, the bridal party goes, but they're missing half the bridal party.
Yeah.
And so that means they're missing loved ones. It's not whole.
It makes me think of like the scripture about the body of Christ, and like the body does not function without all of its parts. And I love the way that you've described this and explained this, David, because I've never heard this parable talked about in this way, that the entire bridal party failed. Like they all messed up. And it makes me think like, yeah, of course we want to make sure everybody can get on the bus. And religion has been so excluding. We talk about not wanting to see anybody excluded, but I think that whole idea of at least the way I was brought up in church was that whole you've got to get your ticket, you've got to get your fire insurance, so to speak.
Right.
That's not what I have found as I have grown in my faith to be a very helpful, or even when I put it up against the gospel, an accurate way in which faith is to be lived out, I don't think. So I'm really appreciative of hearing the way that you have described the parable, because it rings more true to me in this way than the way I have heard it and heard it interpreted mm-hmm. in the past. Because I was always afraid, because I want to be that bridesmaid that's prepared, that has enough oil and extra. And so, like, I didn't want to be the one that failed, but I like it now. Like, we all fail if we do that.
Right.
We all fail. And I just wonder, what the church would look like if we took that mindset, that let's make sure everyone gets on the bus. Let's make sure everyone has a seat at the table, because that is what Jesus did.
Yeah, and if you can take yourself there, I think you can understand this story phenomenologically, and maybe Jesus intended it that way. He didn't say people who get into the kingdom of heaven are like this. He said the kingdom of heaven is like this. He was describing something. Mm-hmm. And maybe he was describing the church as we understand it, where some people get in and some don't, because those mm-hmm. people think they're special in some way. You know, they've done some things to kind of up their karma level or something. They think that's enough for them, and so they call themselves wise. He said the kingdom of heaven is like that. We have people who are like that.
Mm.
He's being descriptive.
And that's so true for so many of the parables. We often bring our own moral lens to the reading of the parables, and they aren't intended to be read that way, most of them, because they usually start out, the kingdom of heaven is like, and then there's a story. But Jesus never says what part of it is like it. That whole story is a part of the kingdom of heaven, right? So
I'd like to lay out like all the parables now and just go, okay, like here's a little piece. Here's a little piece. Like after you said that, like to get a more complete picture of the kingdom of heaven, I would think you would want to look at all of the parables.
Right. And there's some doozies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a quilt, like a patchwork quilt,
mm-hmm.
putting it together.
I'm feeling an art piece coming on.
I don't paint. Spoken word, but not. I don't sing.
David sang beautifully for us.
Yes.
Yes, he did. You had to
he has
an
quite
album.
A voice. I had no idea. He's got some richness in there.
But still, when you're looking at this, I
is he blushing?
He is blushing.
I've been startled, okay? Don't startle me. You know what will happen.
I rarely see him speechless.
I know.
And he stopped for a minute. He says, you have a lovely voice.
I know, because I was thinking about what I was going to say next, and now I got startled. We're looking at Kingdom of Heaven from top down, and still, I'm thinking top down, and it's so descriptive, because this is the church we know, where certain people think they're in and they got it, and certain people are left out. And the ones who are saying, I'm in, I've got that, will turn to the other one and say, oh, sorry, dude, I can't help you out here. You're going to have to go take care of this on your own. And we might put in a good word for you, but you notice when they got back to the gate, they were told, we don't know who you are. So apparently they didn't put a good word for them either.
Right.
Yeah, so there's politics in the kingdom of heaven as they describe it here.
So I want to talk about the politics for a minute.
Oh.
So one of the things that has been educational for me as I have become more acquainted with the Black church tradition mm-hmm. is that there is a line in the White church tradition that we draw often around the work of the church and the public square. Now, I'm a proponent of the separation of church and state, but what the Black church has made me rethink is this notion that the church's voice doesn't need to be loud and strong in the public square, calling for the values of our faith, calling for justice, calling for inclusion. And I look at the shape of the church and maybe hope for the shape of the church to come. And I wonder if part of what we're being called to do as a church in this time. There is so much to which we ought to and should be speaking. There is so much around which we have a word of good news to share. And we ought to be out there sharing it. And I think our Black church friends could teach us a lot about how that can look. And so I got an email today from Bill Rogers, who was the dean of the School of Christian Education when David Adams and I were there 100,000 years ago. He's retired now, but his daughter, Melissa Rogers, is still very active, and she focuses very strongly on the work of faith communities in the public square. How do faith communities play a part in the work of our culture, of our communities, as we try to figure out how are we going to live together? And they just published, I mean, it's hot off the press, a new piece that's called A Time to Heal, A Time to Build. Now, I want to preface this by saying we're recording this on October the 23rd. It is before November 3rd, so we have no idea how things are going to turn out. So don't hear me being partisan here, all right? But what I hear in their article, and this is an article by Melissa Rogers and E.J. Dionne, they are looking ahead to what is the role that the church and voices of faith needs to play, that basically that our culture needs us to play in the coming days, because there are challenges that cannot be met without our voice and our work. Mm-hmm. So if you don't mind, let me read to you just a portion from the introduction to this work. And you can find this. They both are fellows at the Brookings Institute. So this is what they say in the intro. Our leaders should never underestimate the power of a call to service as they confront a pandemic, the scourge of systemic racism, a deep economic recession, and a dangerously warming planet. Government must act boldly in all these spheres, and yet government will not succeed alone. At the outset, the work of community-serving leaders and organizations should be recognized, both religious and non-religious, and their help sought as we move forward. Our nation is hurting and dangerously divided, said the Reverend Brian McLaren. And he goes on, he says, we ask you to represent not only your own interests, but also to help us seek the common good together. And they go on to write, religious institutions and congregations with their deep roots in communities across our nation have a special opportunity and responsibility to help address the profound racial disparities revealed by the pandemic. And they go on. My point being, I think we have a role to play, as we've described from this parable, that it's not just for each of us, but we together play a role in the public sphere and in our communities. And that voice of faith is needed. So normally I wrap after an eloquent reading like that, but I'm going to pause for a moment in case my counterparts want to say something about this.
You're speaking to my Enneagram 8 heart, like champion of justice, right? This week, I'm involved in a clergy emergency league, who, because of kind of the nature of what's been going on in our world, clergy uniting to speak out in the ways that you're saying. And I was struck because they've posted these trainings for poll chaplains to go to the polls to be like a witness to and to protect democracy. And I had never heard of that. And I thought, what an amazing way in which, you know, you're to be able to support and to make sure that every person's voice is heard. So, yeah, I mean, what you're saying, I wholeheartedly hear it. I believe it. I'm ready. Sign me up. You know, that's just, I wish that the church used to be like that, right? I think, like, some of the church history that I've studied, there are times in history where we have, and I think too, as you were saying that, the thing that I would say yes, but with caution. And when I say that is there have been times throughout history that the church has used that type of voice and that type of influence to counter, to get in with political stuff and to try to manipulate and change our country and our lives. And so I think I want it to always be held up against what is the gospel message and what would Christ be calling us to?
I think we have another responsibility that is a little bit harder to see. I'm struggling with it because at my church, I've been preaching for months now about these big social issues and all the things that are going on. It is sometimes hard to remember the little tiny issues and the tiny places where lives have been broken by what's going on. You know, so we hear stories about our parishioners and people who we minister with in other ways where they can't talk to a family member anymore. You know, we hear the tragedy of people who drop mom or dad off at the front door of the hospital and never saw them again. You know, we hear all these big things coming down to very small things that affect individual people's lives and individual things they worry about. Really now, I guess if you're talking about the political thing, this idea that families can't get along, that family Thanksgivings don't happen anymore, that these big picture things we talk about and are in all the news are more important than our personal relationships and our kinship. You know, those are big, big deals. And there's nobody as equipped to talk about that as the church is.
David, very much like you, I am a big proponent of the separation of church and state. It was a part of my faith tradition growing up all the time. It was very, very important. And also, I wish that I had learned how to better incorporate my faith in my politics, because I feel like that because there was such an emphasis on that separation that I never learned. I'm having to learn that kind of discourse in my adult years rather than being able to grow up immersed in being able to do that. But the one thing that I know to be so very true is that Jesus was absolutely political. Jesus talked about politics all the time. He criticized government and religious leaders who were harmful to vulnerable people. And people say, and I think it's true, political is personal. David, to your point, like big political issues come down to individual people and what happens in our collective everyday lives. And so I am all for the church learning how to have this discourse in the public sphere, how to call for things that our faith find important without getting into bed with individuals who are running. And while I think that is an important and fine line to walk, I don't think it's all that fine. It's a matter of making statements and speaking for what we know to be how God has called us to live, and seeking a government that will make policies in that way, but not relying on one individual personality to do that. So,
it's not about us seeking power.
Right.
It's about us vouching for those who have less of a voice,
right,
and who are often held back or oppressed by systems.
And often I think it's actively giving up power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this parable, it's challenging, and in the sense of being prepared for whatever might be thrown at us, whatever challenges we might find ourselves facing, we are finding ourselves facing really, really big challenges. And it is comforting to know that in the end, God will have God's way. But it is also a reminder that we are called to walk alongside and to follow in God's work here and now. May we all be good stewards of that responsibility in these important days. Thank you all for this good conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Subscribe to the Faith Element podcast on iTunes or Google Play.
Learn more about our Faith Element Bible study curriculum at faithelement.net. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.